Picture this. You're on a John Deere compact tractor, enjoying the sun as you clear brush across your pasture. You just have to get in the seat. Learn more at johndeere.com/get in the seat or visit a dealer near you.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hi, welcome to this edition of Why Not Mint Money. Inflation, the Russia-Ukraine war, rising crude oil prices, and US Federal Reserve rate hikes have lashed markets globally. Mint asked a panel of experts whether this is a buyer's or a seller's market. The experts are Shankar Sharma, Vice Chairman and MD of First Global, Nilesh Shah, Group President and MD of Kotak Mahindra Mutual Fund, Deepak Shenoy, Founder and CEO of Capital Mind, and Nikhil Kamath, Co-Founder of Zerodha. Let's listen in.
Hi, welcome to Why Not Mint Money, a personal finance podcast where we help you understand basic money concepts and share strategies for you to build your wealth. So let's get started on your money journey.
Let me first invite Nikhil Kamath to lay out the bearish case.
Yeah, thank you, Neil. I think we have like three or four big issues. I would say not particularly for India. A lot of these are global, but they do affect us in India. I think for a long time, this trade deficit has been a problem. But ever since this rally in crude and commodity price inflation, I think it's becoming a bigger and bigger issue of late. At $20 billion plus per month, I don't think it will take a long time for India to, in a way, run out of the reserves that we have. Inflation again, even today, even with 8% inflation and them raising the federal funds rate to 1.6 or 1.7, there does not seem to be a logical path as to how they will contain inflation by virtue of doing that. I think this is an issue which is not just in the US, but across the world. I would say trade deficit, I would say inflation, a general slowdown in the economy. I think we were slowing down pre-pandemic at a significant pace. But we seem to have a structural problem in the country. So for these three or four reasons, I would say markets seem expensive. I could even argue that even today, on a relative basis, India seems to have collected lesser than other countries. And those would probably be the starting points, Neil, towards making a bear case.
Right. I have seen several data points which seem to suggest that the role of FIIs is diminishing in our markets. Nilesh, what is your take on this? Do the FIIs still command the same weight, or are retail investors making a difference?
So, Neil, investors are investors. Whether they are foreign or they are local, both need to make money on their capital employed. FPIs were owning 21.5% of NSE 200 at the peak holding. In March 22, they came down to 19.5%. And based on the selling of April, May and June, probably they are somewhere around 19%. In recent times, they were at the lower of 18.6%. So undoubtedly, they are an important part of our market. They have been selling for last 7-8 months. But that's probably also because India has delivered double the return of its emerging market peers in last 8 years. As oil prices go higher, we will get impacted because our oil intensity is higher. And probably India is the only market where they are able to get an exit without much price impact, because there is domestic investor buying in. So FPIs continue to play an important role in our market. And while it is encouraging that domestic retail investors are participating in market, we need to augment domestic and global capital together to pursue higher growth.
So Nilesh, you therefore concur with Nikhil's bearish assessment that this correction has a lot further to run.
So India is a country which does not disappoint an optimist or a pessimist. In my opinion, a lot will depend upon how events shape up. What if tomorrow there is a political solution to Ukraine? the war comes to an end and oil prices come down. In that scenario, certainly market outlook will be brighter. The second thing could be, what if US removes sanction on Iran, Venezuela? What if it persuades Saudi Arabia to break OPEC cartelization and energy prices come down? Undoubtedly, as Nikhil mentioned, we run higher trade deficit, but we import about $70 billion of gold every year. This is at the current run rate of $6 billion a month. Now, gold is not an item of consumption, it is an item of investment. We are paying $50-60 billion extra for higher oil prices. So if tomorrow things change, certainly market outlook will also change.
Right. So essentially, we need an external trigger like the war coming to an end, or the cartel, the OPEC cartel going away or being reduced some in some way. Deepak, how do you see this? You very famously wrote a piece where you explained how retail investors seem to be driving the market. Is that not the case anymore?
I think the retail investor continues to drive the trading volumes in the market. And that has come about. It's not something new. India's always had a 20% plus volumes coming in from retail. And this time it's gone. It went all the way to 40. And now it's down to about 30% possibly. And they continue to be drivers in the futures and options markets. It's just that retail investors don't seem to hold their positions too long, because after all of this, they own like 9% of all the stocks in terms of market cap. Mutual funds own about 9 or 10%. FIIs own about 19%. Promoters own roughly 50% of the overall market cap in India. So the people, so I think retail investors continue to drive volumes. They just don't seem to hold. Having said that, I don't think there will be a position where retail investors alone are able to counter, for instance, a large amount of selling by foreign institutional investors, which although has happened at a brisk pace, we haven't seen liquidation level selling from foreign investors yet, as in that they will sell at any price, and they have done this in the past. It's happened in 2008, it's happened in 2020, and we haven't seen that liquidation level selling, at which time we'll actually see whether domestic players are able to offset in any meaningful way whatever is happening in terms of the selling by FPIs. It's a normal part of markets, though. We have only 16% from the top.
Right. So far we focused on flows and who is driving the market, FII or DII. But really, in the long term, fundamentals matter. And there, how does the scenario for India look? Shankar, how do you see this?
So India is basically Andho Mein Kana Raja situation. So while our fundamentals are not worth, a lot, but relative to fundamentals elsewhere, we are looking absolutely smashingly good. And in markets, that's usually good enough to ensure at least one thing, which is outperformance. So I don't think absolute returns are anywhere on the horizon just yet. That will happen. That will change. Markets are not permanently good or bad. But fundamentally speaking, we have our own problems. We have our challenges. We have seen how, our debt to GDP, our trade deficits, the twin deficits themselves are on a very, very worrisome path, for sure. And it can only worsen from here, given where the rupee is headed, which I think is sharply lower. So all things considered, we have our problems. Not that India is in some other planet with no problems. We have problems, but relative to what one observes in the US, for example, or even in China, for example, which are, let's say, the two major economies in this world. And of course, Latin America has another set of problems. Relative to the world, we are looking good on fundamentals. So that's all I can say. And therefore, I do believe that while, we will hurt, we are hurting, we will hurt a lot less than rest of the world. So I think if people had a choice of, if I had a you know, choice of putting market into putting money into only one market, that would be India. As simple as that. It does not mean I'm going to make quick bucks, quick gains. It'll be a painful process out of this current pickle of a situation. But it is the least worst option for an investor who has options to invest globally.
That's actually quite heartening, because if FIIs are getting out, they are making stocks at good fundamentals cheaper for the likes of us.
Let me add to that. The FIIs are getting out of stocks where they can get out of. Okay. The interesting thing here is that those are precisely the stocks that you should not be owning, because they are actually overvalued stocks. I mean, for example, banks are 35-40% of the index. Most FIIs own truckloads of them. They have been overweight and grossly wrong on most of them for the last several years. For that matter, mutual funds. And those are saleable. They are large and liquid names, but they are not great investments. So they are selling those. Doesn't mean you have to necessarily go and buy those. In fact, the under-owned part of the market by FIIs is really the small and the smallest part, smallest cap part of the market. And that is the area where you'll actually be, let's say, less vulnerable to large sell-offs by FPIs and FIIs or whatever you want to call them. Because they will sell what can be sold. You cannot, for the love of or for money, sell a small cap stock in a market like today's, for example. It's they become non-saleable. And FPIs don't anyway own a lot of them. So that's actually, in a perverse way, the safest part of the market from the brunt of FPI selling.
Despite the seller rally in small caps over the past few years.
Yes, so I believe that is the single best part of the market that I can see, where, notwithstanding the current sell-off, a year from now, many, many stocks will be a lot higher.
Nikhil, would you agree with that assessment, that smaller caps offer refuge in this sell-off?
To a certain extent, maybe, but... I think smaller cap companies also tend to have a lesser moat around them. They're not generally sitting on a lot of liquidity, and they generally are a bit more levered than larger cap companies. So maybe in the current scenario, yeah, but when things get worse, if things get worse, another 20% down if markets were to go there.
Now, the other big rotation that's happening, and you know, for the past more than a couple of months, is from growth to value stocks. Nilesh, to what extent do you think, you know, staying in value will shield one from the overall sell-off?
So growth, value, growth at reasonable price, these are all the, you know, class and compartments created by investors. At the end of the day, you make money by balancing between your greed and fear, by focusing upon valuation. Now, there were companies which were cheap and hence called value. They got re-rated based on certain events, like coal prices went up, coal companies went up, power prices went up, power company went up. So my recommendation is that let's not fragment yourself in growth versus value versus GARP. Focus on buying good companies run by good managers, available at good prices. Very easy to say, very difficult to execute.
Now, Nikhil, you're 50% hedged into Beacon, but is there a approximate level? I'm not going into exact numbers here, but is there an approximate level where you think the market becomes attractive?
So, Neil, up until today, I think today for the first time in a long time, we saw like a 500 point correction from 920 to 330, and there was basically no attempt at a recovery whatsoever. So I don't think there was much panic in the market up until today. You know, we went up from 7,500 to 18,500, and maybe we sit at 15,500 today, which in isolation might not seem like a significant correction, whatever, 18, 19, 20%, right? But things are starting to look like, you know, people are panicking for the first time. And generally in market cycles, whatever I have seen, things get a lot worse before they start to get better. So I would say that true panic has not come into the market yet. The one thing we can all kind of agree on is inflation on the ground, pragmatically, it feels like it's a lot higher than the 7-8% official number. And if it were to actually be higher, I think interest rates will have to go up for a significant amount of time before they're truly contained, even in India. So if interest rates go up to that, you know, like 10% level, which today has become fathomable to a certain extent, there will be corporate margins which hurt a lot. You take anything from real estate to, you know, manufacturing. Take the most levered of industries to begin with. I think margins will see significant impact. So how much you downgrade earnings in the next year or in 2024, I think that's a very tough question for someone to answer, because nobody truly knows where interest rates will be 2 years from now and how much corporate margins will get impacted. But the one thing I can say fairly is the pain does not seem like it's over. And I don't think the next 2 years will probably be like the crazy bull markets of the previous year or the previous 2 years that we've witnessed. I think there will be pain, and I don't think it'll be short-term pain, but it'll be long-lasting pain.
We seem to be heading towards quite a bearish consensus here. Can I invite anybody who'd like to offer some kind of positive that investors can focus on?
I can say one thing. If all of us are bearish, it's probably a good thing for the market, right? Generally, when we all have consensus, the opposite happens.
So, Neil, I don't think so. We are bearish or bullish. We need a little bit of luck to change the narrative. If energy prices come down, this whole narrative on inflation will disappear and markets will rebound. The FPIs have sold, but remember in March 20, they were selling without any limit. And October, November 20, they came to buy at higher prices. So we have to focus on our growth. Today, we are in far better situation despite current challenges compared to other countries.
Sure. So India is better on a relative basis, as Shankar also said. And in the long run, fundamentals win out. But in the short run, there will be a lot more pain. That seems to be the broad consensus here. Deepak, you want to add to that?
I just want to add, I mean, I'm very bullish longer term. I just don't feel that right now is a great, I mean, this is a function of liquidity. When you take out money from a market in general, worldwide, and that's what's happening, the RBI has contracted its balance sheet by 500,000 crores. Well, not the excess liquidity has come down by about 500,000 crores in general in the economy, and that's been driven by the RBI. The Fed has not yet even started, and they've only started talking about doing it from now on. In such a situation, you can be bullish about the economy, and the economy will do well, but the markets will not perform correspondingly, because liquidity is what drives markets. So we can be bullish about the economy. It's a great country. It's a great this thing. But, you know, markets will behave badly when liquidity goes out of them. And some stability is reached. It's like you have to brace for impact, take the pain and move on. It doesn't make sense to, you know, at least for me, it doesn't make sense to be to say that I don't like the Indian economy, or because I think the markets may fall more, that I don't like the economy. I think economically we will do well. It's just that markets may not correspondingly perform.
Deepak, I have a question. Do you have any indicator that will tell you that the markets have bottomed out?
If I had one, I wouldn't tell anybody I did.
Nice. Shankar, do you have any indicator?
Yeah, there are many indicators, boss. Many indicators, not one.
Can you share?
But if I tell you, I will have to kill you.
You know, we don't have a lot of bearish commentary in India. In fact, we have Cat3 AIFs, which are technically hedge funds. But I haven't heard of one which is net short. Nikhil, if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, so Neil, in Cat 3, I mean, you can be net short, but the problem is taxation. So on the short side of the portfolio, the derivative side of the portfolio, they tax you as a trust. And you end up paying 43% tax on the gains made on the short side. So if you net turn profitable by being short, you pay like 43% of that as tax. That's a big problem.
Interesting. That's like an inbuilt long bias. Now, the other thing I was curious about is, are global markets better than us in some ways? I mean, you know, a year ago, you were talking about how the tech titans would take over the world, the Zooms, the Metas. Now, all of that seems to have gone into reverse. So have the fundamentals there changed, Nikhil?
So, Neil, we are a very, very small market. Like, I feel like we've done an incredible job of marketing and branding what we truly are. I was looking at some data earlier today, and the number of unique investors who trade in the equity market on a daily basis in India is something like, you know, 15 lakh people. At the peak, it was 20, 25 lakh people. We're not a very large market. Like, compared to, say, America, by virtue of market cap or by virtue of the number of investors or traders, you know, we're next to insignificant. You know, we have tech companies here in India, but there is very little innovation that truly happens in India. Even companies like ours and companies in our ecosystem, we are companies which are able to kind of regurgitate what has happened in the West and replicate better, and those companies scale in India. Structurally, that is a problem for India, that so little innovation, so little money actually goes towards research in India. For that reason alone, I think American companies continue to remain extremely attractive, both by virtue of the fact that they spend most innovation dollars and they truly have scale.
So, to put it succinctly, yes, there are kind of better companies, at least in the tech space in the US, you would say. And some of them seem to be trading on even cheaper valuations.
So, the tech stocks in America are really cheap. They have been cheap for the last 2 years also. I mean, I've looked at those companies. You look at even FANG stocks, or, you know, just slightly south of the FANG stocks. I mean, mid-teen multiples for really globally sized and scaled companies. While in India, even for, you know, very mediocre companies, 40, 50, 80, 100 times earnings has been par for the course. And not just in the last 2 years, but I mean, over decades, which is why I've always felt that you know, it's just India. Many Indian companies do not deserve these multiples. And I've been wrong. They've traded these multiples now consistently. I think for 25 years, all your FMCG set has been north of 50 times earnings as a general pack. Even our banks have traded at 4 or 5 times book value. Again, insanely high relative to most other banks. So India is not a cheap market, and US has been a really cheap market on the tech side. I mean, really amazingly cheap. But that said, I've never believed that valuation itself is the be all and end all of making money in stock markets. I mean, overvalued things can keep getting more and more overvalued. We've seen that over cycles. Undervalued things can remain undervalued a long time. And in India, in fact, you know, this is the, you know, we have heard that in the 90s also. And we used to joke about it that the P/E ratio is basically nothing but a representation of the number of years a company remains in business. U.S. tech has been cheap, but I don't think they are great buys, because in a lot of ways, the go-go years for them are probably, you know, behind them. Ultimately, if you think about it, a lot of those companies will hit a wall in terms of where they can grow, because China is shut out for almost all of them.
Shankar, if not US tech, then is there any sector or market that does currently represent good value?
I'm telling you, Indian small caps, guys. I mean, take a look at a company like Wadilal. Okay, I bought the stock at 1,000 rupees in March. Today, it is 1,900 rupees. Who says Indian market has been a terrible market? I'm giving you one example. I can give you 25 more. The point is that in a bear market, we are in a bear market. Let us accept it, okay? You will have to work harder to get to those 25, 50 names, okay? In a bull market, all of us, we need to show up. That's it. You need to show up. You will make money. You'll go home. This is not that market. This is a tough market. In a tough market, you will need to be very nimble, agile, hardworking, figuring out companies, meeting companies. In a bull market, you don't need to meet every, you know, anybody. It's a broad trend you're betting with. So, as I said, India small caps are a fantastic place to be in. And I remain absolutely firm in my view that a year from now, many of those companies would be up significantly, or at least will not be down as much as broad markets in India and globally might be.
Fair enough. One other solution, of course, that's often discussed to this kind of market is asset allocation. And, you know, AMCs across the country have products aimed squarely at that. Nilesh, how much can asset allocation really protect investors?
So the question, Neil, is does trader want a protection? Does investor want a protection? Even in today's market, most equity funds returns are in double digit from second year onwards. And it is negative on a 1 year basis. Now, if you can take the downside, then certainly asset allocation will protect an investor. Asset allocation does not mean that you don't have to take downside. There is no free lunch in the market. You have to take upside as well as downside. And today, there are different kinds of asset allocation funds which are available. So, if you are an investor looking for a long-term investment, asset allocation funds are like fill it, shut it, forget it kind of fund. It does not protect you from downside, but it ensures that in a cheaper market, you are adding asset classes. In an expensive market, you are booking profit. We have our balance advantage fund, which does allocation between debt and equity. It can go between 20 to 80% in cash equity, depending upon market valuation. In Jan 20, we were at 39% equity. With the benefit of hindsight, we should have been 20%, but fair enough, 39 was not bad. In March 20, we were at 75% equity. We should have been 80%, but fair enough, 75 is not bad. Today, we are at roughly 49% equity, and I'm sure today we would have bought something more. So asset allocation can give you a discipline. It can't protect you from downside. There is no free lunch.
Nilesh, so just continuing along that, we have a feature where we ask fund managers how they invest their own portfolios. And if I could just ask you the broad asset allocation question that, you know, how much would you be in equity and how much in debt?
So my portfolio right now is about 70% in equity and about 30% in real estate, debt, gold, and offshore assets.
You're, I mean, quite strongly affected by the market in terms of your portfolio. But of course, you would have a much higher risk appetite than the ordinary investor, just to make that clear.
So my risk appetite is not higher. I'm not leveraged. I never leverage. But I'm a long-term investor, and hence this 70-30 I can afford.
Yeah, fair enough.
And Nilesh, just one follow-up question. How much cash are you in right now?
So I really don't have luxury of keeping cash. Whatever money comes, goes by way of my SIP into NPS and mutual fund. And bearing those emergency money, which my wife will require, I hardly have any cash balance.
Yeah, fair enough. I think it's time for closing comments. So Nikhil, can we start? We began with you, so we'll take the first closing comment from you.
Yeah, sure. So just as a theme, Neil, I think, you know, there's a very interesting book called Donut Economics. It talks about how we have been convinced to think that growth is good and how companies are made to believe that you have to constantly grow and that makes you a better company. I think ignoring the economics of it all, the world will have many other problems in the future that we might not have seen in our own past in the last 20 years or whatever. And we might arrive at this point where growth comes at a cost. And, you know, countries which have done well, the developed Western countries, they've done that on the back of, you know, a lot of carbon and a lot of extracting resource from the planet in a way. But for the emerging countries like India, I think when when the future turns to a place where you have to kind of like justify the cost to the environment, we might somehow suddenly be stuck in this place where Western nations have taken advantage of that same resource, but it might become harder for us to do the same. So I personally feel companies which mitigate that over the next decade or two, it could be companies around better sources of storing energy. It could be a better form of creating electricity, transmission. It could be a geoengineering company which is able to manipulate temperature in a certain region. It could be something that, cleans up the water and makes a serious impact in pollution, or reduces air pollution in Delhi, for example. I think that's a huge industry. We don't have any companies of scale which are operating around that in India. But that might become the theme of the next two decades, like maybe IT was the theme of the last two decades. And, personally, when I'm investing through my fund on the private side, I constantly look for companies like this. There again, the problem is that a lot of this innovation lies outside of India, but we have to figure out how to inculcate these companies in India and then really back them, because that will probably be relevant in the decades to come.
Right. Shankar?
Right. So first and foremost, one of the key things to remember is that we've had a pretty long, not India. India has been in a, I still believe we are in a bear market, and we have been so for the last, 13 years. If you look at the compounded returns from January 2008 up until now, we are still barely, in the 8 or 9% kind of territory, which is nothing for a high interest rate economy like India. So if you only look at a recency bias driven mindset, the last 2 years have been good. But on a long term basis, Indian equities have delivered extremely disappointing returns. So to that extent, we are better off, because things that do the best do the worst in a bear market. And the US has done the best over the last 11 or 12 years, right from, let's say, 2010-11 onwards, when the emerging markets went into a relative bear market. And US went into a huge relative bull market. That cycle, I think, has run its course. And therefore, I think the US will hurt. US consumption is hurting. As I just mentioned, US tech companies, the big drivers of the US tech bull market, have probably hit a wall in terms of their growth options. So I think the US will hurt a lot more than the rest of the world, merely because it did the best. And remember, there's a lot of irresponsibility by central banks of the developed world. Not to say that our central banks in Asia have done much better, because even in India, debt to GDP is now, I think, in the mid-90s now, which used to be in the mid-60s about 6 years back. So there has been profligacy for right or wrong reasons across the world. The West has taken it to a different level. I think all of that had to have a cost. It could not be cost-free that you could just, do all that you did without really at the core fixing the core economic problems that led to the 2008 crisis. So you just opened the spigots. You made an ordinary set of sprinters into Ben Johnsons by this permanent dose of steroids. But ultimately, there were Ben Johnsons. We are realizing that now. And, we know how that story ended. We know this story is also going to end badly, at least for the developed countries. Therein lies opportunity for emerging markets. That's why I think on a relative basis, India is absolutely the best market that I can see. I think even China relatively will do well, because it has been a dog market over the last year or 2 years. If you look at Chinese internet stocks, Baba is up 25% in the last month's time. NetEase is up, JD is up. So a lot of Chinese companies have beaten the numbers estimates and have done actually very well, in the last one and a half months of carnage. So I think the needle is moving towards EMs away from the developed markets, and which should make domestic Indian investors who are limited in terms of their options to invest overseas very, very happy.
Indeed. Deepak?
Yeah. So I think, quite interesting from a discussion angle. I think I would say India has a tremendous amount of inefficiencies. And therefore, they're just bridging those inefficiencies, whether it is in the logistics areas, whether it is in whether it is in transportation, whether it is in communication. All of these inefficiencies will be broken down either through technology or through new companies or through existing companies expanding their offerings over the course of the next decade or so. This is where the massive opportunities lie, because I think this is where the biggest growth stories of the next decade will be formed. I think our country has largely been too focused on things like aluminium and steel and all of that stuff as players in indexes. I think it's the players that will break down inefficiencies that will survive. I don't know if a lot of them will, are even born today, but I do know that a lot of players are still playing. Example in electric vehicles, it's not about being green, but it's actually about being substantially more efficient running an engine which is feasible today, running off of a battery, providing greater horsepower, lower maintenance cost, and a much much smoother ride with no need for moving parts and all of that. This will change the world. It will change India as well. It will change India in probably different ways from the way it changed the world. The internet on your handheld mobile changed India in a way that I think has never seen before, and a lot more things will come going forward. I believe here is the opportunity. The next few months may still be problematic for the markets, but I don't think you should let that blindside you into believing that India is a basket case, because I think everybody here on the panel also has said this and reiterated, there is a substantially good position India is in. And I'll add two things over here. One, things that are bothering the world today are inflation, because they haven't seen it. We've seen a lot of it. We don't have a problem if the price of a dosa goes up from 25 rupees to 50 rupees in the course of 10 years. America has problems if the price of fuel goes up from $3 to $5 in the course of 20 years. So they haven't been used to inflation. We are perfectly used to it. We know where we are a little more capable of handling it. And two areas where inflation has affected the world today or is affecting it is food and fuel, both of which are relatively less in India. India's fuel inflation right now, on a year-on-year basis, is a lot lesser because the government has cut taxes and all of that stuff. But also, the food inflation is relatively lower compared to the rest of the world, because we make a lot of the food that we eat, and we don't allow our food to be exported for the most part. So I believe we'll come out of this stronger, both because the crisis is going to hurt us a little bit less economically. Markets, of course, it'll hurt us more because, like Nikhil said, we're really small markets. We trade 48,000 crores a day today. And a day like today, we trade 48,000 crores. That's like one stock in the US for about 3 hours. Our whole market put together, intraday plus delivery stocks, traded just less than what one US stock would trade for 3 hours in a day. It's that small. So we will get affected from a market perspective. But I think economy-wise, which is what matters in probably the longer run, we should do really well in the next decade. So I think focus more on the next decade and, brace for impact in the next few months.
It's almost the reverse of COVID, right? Where we expected the economy to go down and the markets did well. It's almost like the reverse of that. Last word to you.
Well, Neil, what happened with Indian cricket team is happening now with Indian economy. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you could almost say that Indian cricket team was Shivaji Park Gymkhana cricket team. There were 5 or 6 players from Mumbai around him. The entire cricket used to evolve. And then there were many urban participants. That team occasionally used to win. Most of the time used to draw. And couple of times also lose the match. Then democratization happened. People from semi-urban and rural India also started coming into play. Dhoni came from Ranchi. Kapil Dev came from Chandigarh. Though it can't be called a rural area. But this democratization changed the Indian cricket team. Now we go and win the test matches. Sometimes we draw and occasionally we lose. we have become number one test team on an almost consistent basis. The same thing is happening in Indian economy. Earlier, our growth was driven by large entrepreneurs, the house of Tatas, Birlas, Ambanis. Now, there is availability of capital to deserving idea. I couldn't become businessman because my parents didn't have enough capital. My daughters don't need my capital because if they have idea, they'll go and raise it in the market. And this democratization or availability of capital will unleash the entrepreneurial spirit, keep the faith on long-term India story. There's no free lunch in the market. So my recommendation, keep the faith, sip karo, mast raho.
Indeed, well said. On that note, thank you very much. It was a very instructive discussion, and I hope that in these troubling times, you've got some more information and some more insights to guide you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, bro.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil. Thanks, everyone.
That's it for today. If you have any questions, you can write to us at mintmoney@lyman.com.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.